the role of proximity as it concerns doing good or attempting to do good, attempting to do charity can be explored. What does that mean? So, let's start off with a practical example. Say that we hear that somebody was walking down the street and they saw a child very unfortunately hurt or about to be hurt, and they could have helped without jeopardizing their life or limb at all, but they didn't. And they just passed by and maybe took a picture to post it on social media and just walked away. We would say that person is, to put it politely, not a good person. And to put it less politely, stronger terms could be found. And yet, if we're told that that same person or some other person did not actively go out of their way to find a child to help, we wouldn't say that, right? We wouldn't say that that's a bad person. We'd say, well, of course, that's normal. I probably don't do that either. And we can find, or we can offer innumerable such specific enough examples. Somebody is choking at the restaurant in front of me. If I ignore that, because perhaps I'm physically incapacitated or disabled myself, I'm perfectly able, and I simply look on, maybe laugh, again, maybe take a picture. All would agree that I am a moral monster. But if I don't every day drive around restaurants looking for people that are choking, nobody would say that there's anything wrong with me. In fact, that would be wrong with me, or something would be wrong with me if I did that. Right? I'm going to just drive around each and every restaurant today looking specifically to find somebody to help out. You can pull up at any time any number of statistics concerning the unfortunate things that occur every day. Right? People take their own life. People slip and fall. People are poisoned. People are assaulted. Right. Goodness forbid, children are abused, all that kind of stuff. Right. And yet, if we don't do anything about that proactively, our moral intuition does not say there's something wrong with you, right, that I'm not running around looking for cases like that. And yet, if any one of these cases are in front of me, somebody's trying to take their own life in front of me, somebody gives a sign that they're kidnapped to me, and I see it. Somebody slips and falls in my vicinity. I see somebody being abused or treated unfairly in front of me again. Then, all of a sudden, it becomes my business. So what's the logic here? What is really at play that can account at least for our moral intuition, for that apparent discrepancy? So here, that same intuition may kind of point us in a particular direction. Let's see how we can go about it. For one thing, to take those examples to the extreme, we can not only look at statistics of the current year's unfortunate happenings, the number of accidents, the number of crises, this and that, but we can take the largest possible subset, for example, all the individuals that have lived according to best present estimates, and we can see some numbers concerning the amount of people that have lived and have died terrible, apparently, deaths in war and in connection with disease. And we can try to, obviously, we can't actually come close, anywhere close, to fathoming it, but we can at least with our mouth form a statement such that would encompass the entirety of the pain and the suffering and the misfortune that the human race has sustained throughout the ages. Again, I can say with my mouth, wow, imagine the millions, tens and hundreds of millions of people, perhaps billions if we go far enough back, that have been slaughtered in a time of war, right? Brutally slaughtered in extremely painful ways. Imagine the innumerable individuals just like me that have died in connection with diseases that have ate away flesh and kinds of awful stuff like that. Every kind of possible story concerning suffering, concerning heartache and heartbreak, concerning betrayal, concerning abuse, concerning the taking of lives, any kind of drama that one can think of, As long as it's logically possible, it probably has happened prior, and possibly, depending on how creative it is, dozens of times, hundreds of times, millions of times, hundreds of millions of times. How many hundreds of millions again throughout the ages, going back thousands of years, whatever, however far back we need to look, how many hundreds of millions of people have been, say, stolen from? Right? Just casual or a daily occurrence that occurs up to the present day. How many hundreds of millions of people have been disrespected? And that's keeping it PG, and we can go on from there. And yet we see here that for me to concern myself with that sounds just bizarre, right? It sounds ridiculous. Like, what? I'm supposed to really lie awake at night thinking about the people in Mount Vesuvius that got buried, right? And how painful it was. So what gives then? Right? Is that at all a hint as to how proximity has something to do with our ethical obligations? So one thing to say would be that suffering is in reference to desires. Right? I have to have some kind of objectives, and they have to be violated, the objectives to the point where they are active desires, and they have to be violated for suffering to be had. Therefore, suffering is, by necessity, it seems, an aspect of the temporal order. Because in time, desires arise, and they are either negated or satisfied. So, for example, throughout the course of a given day, however many thousands of times it is, I have a desire to breathe, and then I breathe, and then shortly thereafter I have another desire to breathe. As long as there's no issues, no suffering should ensue. If there's an issue, I have to hold my breath for some reason or another. The suffering may ensue, and it's going to climb the longer that this pertinent objective of mine to breathe is nullified. And hopefully, throughout the course of the day, several times I want to eat. And if I don't satisfy that desire, then also the suffering may go up. Eventually, I want to sleep. And if then I'm sleep deprived, somebody keeps waking me up, the suffering can begin to climb up in the next morning when I'm sleep deprived, perhaps. There's physiological objectives concerning heat and concerning cold, and those may vary multiple times throughout the day. I'm too hot, I take off some article of clothing. I'm too cold, I put something on, and so forth and so on. So the satisfaction and the nullification of desires seems intrinsically temporal, intrinsically subject to succession, meaning it comes and it goes, it comes and it goes. Therefore, awful as suffering is at the given moment, it must need necessarily pass. It has to pass. And once it passes, at least of the physiological variety, as we might get to, inner suffering can last, but of the physiological variety, insofar as it applies to the spatial temporal, it eventually has to pass. I'm either going to, the pain is going to subside, or I'm going to lose consciousness, or eventually it simply, the pain will reduce, right? Or worse comes to worst, eventually my body will go the way of the worms, and then certainly the pains that were felt vis-a-vis that body can no longer be felt, vis-a-vis that nervous system. All right, so we see here that to consequently get hung up excessively on that which is exclusively and necessarily temporal, to absolutize it is probably a mistake of reasoning. Suffering really, really sucks in the moment, but the moment passes, and it's the same for pleasure. Right? If we try to build our life around feeling transient pleasure, it's the same idea. Pleasure necessarily passes. It's in reference again to desires. And if I simply try to satisfy my desires without ever having a lull, without ever, first of all, negating my desires, I will gradually or rapidly reduce and then remove my ability to feel pleasure. Obvious example, I have a desire to eat, so it feels good to eat. First bite, second bite, third bite, 50th bite, 100th bite, whatever it might be, feels good to eat dessert. But if I keep eating, eventually, it's going to be uncomfortable. It's certainly not going to be pleasurable. Then it's going to be uncomfortable, and then it will be torture. If I'm forced to eat indefinitely, No matter how hungry I was at first, it's going to be torture. I want to drink water because I'm thirsty, and therefore feeling the water go down my throat feels good. If I keep drinking, I'm forced to keep drinking. Maybe it's a chugging contest. Eventually, I'm no longer thirsty. It's no longer pleasurable. And then it becomes very painful and unpleasant. Right, so we say that if we simply try to fulfill all of our desires endlessly without any such lull, I don't allow myself to get hungry again. I don't allow myself to get thirsty again. I'm constantly entirely satiated. And just so, by the way of the other physiological aspects, I can't feel pleasure. Right? Eventually, I will ruin my ability to feel pleasure. So we say that pleasure and pain, again, are aspects of succession, of that which is intrinsically temporal. We cannot build our life around them. We cannot get hung up on them, and we cannot absolutize them. Therefore, to say that the objective, as some philosophical theories have proposed, the objective of life is to have the maximum amount of moments of pleasure, or to remove the maximum amount of suffering and pain, is philosophically unsound. Right, to put it mildly, and at worst, again, it can absolutely ruin lives. I try to structure my life around feeling pleasure, and perhaps with some stipulations. If I think about what leads to pleasure, and then I intelligently go about things so as to, over the course of time, feel pleasure, that could be a little bit more sensible. But still, all the same, if it's temporal, if it's an aspect of succession, it comes and it goes, that is not the building block of the highest human life. And again, just so for the avoidance of suffering and physical suffering, which comes about in connection with the objectives of the body, I make it my goal to avoid all physical suffering, then I'm going to suffer even more. Because suffering is involved, for example, in exercise. It's involved in exertion, any disruption of homeostasis, or a sufficiently severe one. Right? Again, like intense exercise, exposure to heat and cold, which can be healthy. If I try to avoid all suffering, I'm just going to suffer more. So it seems to follow then that, as with other things that come and go, I can structure my life so as to avoid unnecessary physical suffering. I'm bound to do that anyways. Chances are, right, if I hold my breath indefinitely, I'm going to eventually pass out or start breathing. Right? If I don't eat long enough, eventually I'm either going to eat or I'm going to die, and so forth. So that's kind of needless to say. I want to avoid extreme suffering that is not constructive, that is not oriented towards some objective. Intense exercise, something like that. And as for pleasure, I don't want to focus on pleasure. I want to focus on satisfying objectives that my intellect sets. And in the process, I may well feel intellectual and at times physical pleasure. I exert myself, I work hard, and then it feels good to rest. But that's not the goal. I'm not thinking about that. So the initial question, however, that I was thinking about the role of proximity as it relates to ethical obligations. Insofar as in question is simply the suffering and the pleasure of animal bodies, we say that it is no great merit to, for its own sake, in an isolated fashion, to remove that suffering and to add on pleasure. It seems right to say, and it seems nice to say, that the world is made a better place if there's less suffering. And yet, again, if we think about the animal order and we think about the absolute necessity of food chains, predator prey, the spider eating the fly and the bird eating the spider and the coyote, for example, eating the bird and whoever's at the top of the food chain. It has to be that way, right? It has to be. We're never going to convince all the animals to be vegetarians. So if I simply say, you know, I'm a good person and I want to alleviate the suffering of the world in connection with animal bodies, I would have to redo the entire world. I would have to run around and get tremendous crews of volunteers, for example, to rescue each spider, fly, or insect from the spider's web, from the Venus flytrap. But then I would be hurting the spider in the Venus flytrap. And then I would have to try to rescue the spider from the bird. I'd maybe put some kind of covering over each spider web. But then I would be hurting the bird. I would have to try to rescue the mouse from the eagle, but then I would be hurting the eagle. Get the idea? I would have to try to rescue the gazelle from the jaws of the lion, or of the, alligator, crocodile, whatever it would be. But then I would be hurting those respective animals. So we say that the suffering of animal bodies, meaning the nullification of objectives associated with given physiological corporal organizations, is a necessity. There does not seem to be a way to structure reality or the world to avoid that. Even plants, right? Let's say I want to be a vegetarian. Well, plants, some scholars suggest, are much more intelligent and aware than we are liable to give them credit for. We see that even amoeba, single-celled organisms, apparently respond to noxious stimuli and are able to organize themselves and to secure their objectives. So we cannot, even if we want to go full vegetarian, whatever the case might be, we cannot ultimately redo the world so as to avoid animal suffering. So if animal suffering is a given, right, or the bodies that animal bodies shall suffer, objectives relevant to them shall be frustrated. Recalling that we also have those same bodies, we have animal bodies, then what is a worthwhile goal? And an idea would be worthwhile goals concerning rational efforts at improvement of the world. Well, we see that with the rise of the intelligence of the Homo sapien, with the rise of the potentialities of human beings, goods can be introduced into the world such that do not exist by the way of the regular natural order, comprised out of, again, the spiders and the snakes and the bees and the birds and all of that. And these goods, some of them, are such that permit mutual enrichment, meaning the more individuals that partake in them, the greater they become. Some major such goods include that which is called love, that which is called knowledge, and that which is called personal relationships. And that which is called, further, distinct human individuality, such that cannot occur by the way of other animals, and such that cannot occur prior to certain stages of human development. Now, if we grant that the goal is not and cannot be simply to remove the suffering of animal bodies, or to give pleasure to animal bodies, what is the goal concerning ourselves? Right, and each other, and oneself. Well, how about, then, the increase of those distinctly human goods? The increase, and so to say, a cold, dark universe, otherwise devoid of anything worthwhile, the increase in love, in knowledge, albeit probably not of a sterile, vacuous variety. You know, I found out how many grains of sand there are today on the beach, which would be nice, but perhaps of a more profound sort, knowledge, the increase of personal relationships, the increase of genuine human individuality, the increase of human community, fraternity, such that is predicated on goodwill, such that is predicated on love of one's neighbor, whether it be one's literal neighbor or whoever is in one's vicinity. And that can indeed be the clue as to the initial question, which is, why does it sound correct to say that we ought to look out for those directly in front of us and help the person drowning in front of us, but we should not run around looking for those examples? Or we don't need to, should we say? We may, right? I want to be a rescue worker, sure, great. My job is to specifically respond to emergency calls, phenomenal. But it's just that nobody would accuse another person of being a moral monster if they don't, again, drive around looking for people to rescue. But if in front is a person that needs to be rescued, then it's a different story. So that could be the clue. If somebody is in my vicinity and they know that I know that they are suffering and that they need help. Me refusing to so do would be an inhuman act. Here's from my perspective. I'm the one that's suffering. I'm the one that's choking. I'm the one that's drowning. Here's a human being that's supposed to be a fellow human being that's supposed to be able to will my good and see themselves in me, and they do not. And they laugh, they pass me by, they videotape me, and they don't help me. I'm damaged by that ethically. The possibilities of there being more of those uniquely human goods in the universe is reduced, namely love, mutual goodwill, personal relationships, all of that. But those uniquely human goods are not reduced. From my own point of view, as it concerns what I'm able to do, if right now, if even such a now could be elucidated, as say philosophy and physics might dispute, if right now there's some suffering of some bodies somewhere, just like those goods are not reduced by the fact that there was suffering. The fact that people perished again in Mount Vesuvius, these horrible deaths of lava and killing them and all of that, that does not at all stand in the way of me, say, loving my child, loving my spouse, being there for my child and my spouse, and contributing to the rise of those personal relations, to the rise of that love and that goodness that is distinctly human and that is distinctly valuable. Get the idea? That's obviously just a proposition, but it does seem to be at least somewhat sound. From my own point of view, I'm a limited individual, and to me the world exists as an idea, in principle, right? There's the world and the people of the world. Humanity is just an idea, and it only becomes concretized when I see specific individuals and specific avenues of action. Those are my opportunities to contribute to those higher human goods. My own children, my own spouse, my own neighbors, and also the people that become real for me in the course of the day. The person I sit next to on the plane, the person I sit next to on the train, the person that is behind me and in front of me in line, the person that is walking behind me as I go to open the door, that's the person that I can open the door for. I didn't contribute to humanity, not some other person somewhere else. And obviously, the person that needs help that is in front of me, that unfortunately maybe is trying to hurt themselves or hurt somebody else, right, or has slipped and fallen or something like that, that is the person that I can help. That is my opportunity to contribute to there being, again, more of those goods, more of that love and those personal relationships. The fact that I know, in principle, statistically speaking, something like that occurs every moment, something like that has occurred, something like that will occur, that's unfortunate on principle, but it is none of my business, to be perfectly frank. What is my business is what is in front of me, right here and right now. Those are my avenues to contribute to humanity and to contribute to, again, those aforementioned priceless goods. With that said, a stipulation could be added that if a particular individual is in a particular place such that benefit can be had on large scale, I can make some kind of decision and I can avoid a war. Maybe I'm in a submarine and I'm the captain. Am I going to nuke or not nuke? I can cure cancer, something like this. Obviously, then that becomes my responsibility. But we see also, just as a note, that the real good that we can do does appear to be carried out in the form of those personal interactions and personal relationships. If I were to, let's say, cure a disease, did I help humanity or not? Well, indirectly, but not directly, because I cure, I came up with a cure for some disease and I saved the lives of 10 million people. Out of those 10 million people, I also did save the lives of killers and monsters and various perverted, sick individuals and so forth and so on. I also did save the lives of individuals whose humanity will not go up one bit just because they keep on living, right? Just because some anonymous individual contributed to some kind of medicine that enables me to live or came up with some surgical technique, that's not going to improve me as a human being. That's not going to contribute to there being any more of those goods. Good that I live, okay, but all the same. So we see that that's, if that's a particular person's prerogative, then obviously that becomes that person's obligation. In general, the elevation of the medicine, the technology, all that great. But we see that all the same, that is not the real avenue by which we can truly improve or add, should we say, to goods that are valuable in and of their own self. And those avenues do remain, it certainly does seem, personal relationships, personal interactions, and such. And those personal relationships and personal interactions can only be had with the people that are in front of us that we know and that know that we know. All right, so we can think about it. Thank you for listening.